At this point, I'd like to say just a few words about how excruciatingly hard it can be sometimes to transcend our narrow point of view. This is, I think, an important admission or confession about the difficulty of transcendence and our frequent inability to recognize the experience of others, including those we hold most dear. I'll get personal for just a moment. The one that I hold most dear is a woman named Kathleen. And several years ago, she said something to me that changed the way that I think about myself and the relationships that I try to foster. We were in the middle of a disagreement and she shook her head and she lowered her voice and said very quietly, "You just don't see me." Now, she's the one I hold most dear, but Kath is also my third and I vow final wife. So I paid very, very close attention and I had to admit she was right. I was missing something vital about her experience. And now I want to talk about this tone deafness, this certain blindness to the subjective lives of others. So in some respects, my blindness wasn't exactly my fault. Our volition, the practical pursuits that structure and organize our lives, is what keeps us from recognizing the full range of experience. We regularly confuse what is urgent and immediate with what is actually important or miraculous. Our habits, even the very good ones, close us off from what we might see and what we might become. William James wrote, "Blind and dead does the clamor of our own practical interests make us to all other things." In some respect, my blindness wasn't exactly my fault. Our volition and the practical pursuits that structure and organize our lives, this is what keeps us from recognizing the full range of experience. We regularly confuse what is urgent and immediate with what is actually important or even miraculous. Our habits, even the very good ones, close us off from what we might see and what we might become. William James writes, "Blind and dead does the clamor of our own practical interests make us to all other things." His investigation of perception in the 1880s gave James an intimation that would later grow into a full-fledged philosophical insight about the scope and meaning of consciousness. He writes, "Most people live, whether physically, intellectually, or morally, in a very restricted circle of their potential being. They make very small use of their possible consciousness and of their soul's resources in general, much like a man who, out of his whole bodily organism, should get into the habit of using only his little finger." This is true, but it isn't a particularly great excuse for radical insensitivity, and James knew it. Concentrating on one's own intensely meaningful experiences has a tendency to produce what James would later call a certain blindness in human beings. He describes it this way: "Each of us is bound to feel intensely the importance of his or her own duties and the significance of the situations that call these forth. But this feeling is in each of us a vital secret for the sympathy with which we vainly look to others. The others are too much absorbed in their own vital secrets to take an interest in ours, hence the stupidity and injustice of our opinions, so far as they deal with the significance of alien lives. Hence the falsity of our judgments, so far as they presume to decide in an absolute way on the value of other persons' conditions or ideals. In short, we're so busy thinking about ourselves that we don't see anything else. Zest is the vibrant inside of human meaning. But with the seductions of this vibrancy, this seduction of the subjective feeling of zest, here lies the danger of getting lost inside our own point of view. It's too easy to forget that other people's inner lives, their joys and sorrows, their hopes and disappointments, are every bit as immediate and real to them as ours are to us. When we notice strangers at all, it's often as if through the window of a slow-moving car. We drive by, we rubberneck, we gawk, but for most part, strangers are the sorts of things to be avoided. This misanthropy is rooted in a very basic self-centeredness, a narcissism so deep and ubiquitous that it seems altogether normal. We are meaning-making creatures, but for the most part, we are only concerned about the meanings that each of us individually makes. Perhaps we extend care to our immediate circle of friends and loved ones, but that's about it. The rest of the world is beyond us, at least in the sense of genuine recognition. In his essay published in 1898 on a certain blindness in human beings, James admitted that he had long suffered from this type of short-sightedness. On a trip to North Carolina, James explained he traveled through a rural shantytown in the mountains and could find absolutely nothing beautiful or noble or redeemable or meaningful about it. The place just looked dead, no zest at all. He wanted to get out as quickly as possible. As he did, however, James had a thought that gave him pause, one that has often slowed me down in the frantic pursuit of my own zestful experiences. Is it not possible, even quite likely, that the men and women who live here, their children and their pets, all live lives that strive after similar moments of meaning? Is it not possible that they long for and find zest in their surroundings in precisely the way that I do? Yes, it is possible. But now, let's be careful here. James wasn't saying that the strangers whom he sees through a glass darkly have the same experiences that we do, that we should project our own wants and desires on those people we pass on the street or in the market. He was precisely not saying this. He is suggesting that individuals tap meaning and experience in singularly unique ways. In other words, we are the same precisely because there is an irreducible difference between the zests that make our worlds meaningful. And at the same time, the disappointments and tragedy of zest unrealized or zest extinguished is a similar feeling of utter alienation and loneliness. We feel ourselves apart in the same way. In the history of moral theory, ethical communities usually consist of members who share common loyalties or characteristics. Maybe they worship the same god or the same flag. Maybe they all possess reason and that this gives them some sort of incomparable worth. Maybe they all can experience pain and pleasure. There are, however, individuals who are uncommon, who don't worship the right things or exhibit the right attributes. And these deviant individuals aren't granted access to the communities in question. In truth, they're usually treated like outcasts. Communities based on commonality can be surprisingly exclusive. James, like Arthur Schopenhauer, nearly a century earlier, was after an ethical community based on difference. James and Schopenhauer claimed that individuals were companions in misery. Suffering individuates, meaning it is experienced subjectively, in isolation. But this is, in fact, the underlying commonality of the social world. Each of us suffers in our own unique hellholes, according to Schopenhauer. But this is the isolating fact that each of us shares. We don't suffer exactly the same miseries ever, but this difference should be enough to engender a bit of compassion for those around us. James, I think, is making a similar philosophical move. The fact that each living being makes meaning in its own perfectly unique way, that zest, when it arises at all, arises on the inside, first and foremost. This belief is one that connects a Jamesian community without dissolving the individualism that he held dear. James wants to respect difference and individual variation from beginning to end. This is more than what philosophers just call the no harm principle, namely the idea that my freedom ends at the tip of your nose, that I don't have the freedom to punch you in the nose. James takes this very, very seriously and makes an additional claim. He says this, "And now what is the result of all these considerations and quotations? It is negative in one sense, but positive in another. It is absolutely that it forbids us to be forward in pronouncing on the meaninglessness of forms of existence other than our own. And it commands us to tolerate, respect, and indulge those whom we see harmlessly interested and happy in their own ways, however unintelligible they may be to us." James goes on, he says, "Hands off. Neither the whole truth nor the whole of good is revealed to any single observer. Although each observer gains a partial superiority of insight from the peculiar position in which he stands. Even prisons and sick rooms have their special revelations. It is enough to ask of each of us that he should be faithful to his own opportunities and make the most of his own blessings without presuming to regulate the rest of the vast field." This vast field of reality continually outstrips our attempts to understand it. No story captures the whole of life. No one, not even God, can make complete sense of it. In 1897, William James's friend Benjamin Blood wrote that he believed in only lowercase gods and in no climactic results of being. This was James's belief as well, that, in Blood's words, everything happens in the middle of eternity. Eternity affords many truths instead of a single overarching truth. And whatever is true, even in the slightest way, has consequences that make it true. And these consequences matter whether they impact the house I call home or a prison or a sick room I will never visit. My refusal to consider this consists, according to James, in a failure of insight and imagination. His suggestion, when it comes to understanding the inner lives of others, is rather simple. Try harder, be gentle, and remain humble.